Hello and welcome to Holden Village. The date is June 28th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Corporate Media and the Quashing of Dissent, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Well, thank you for coming. Tonight we're going to talk about, I think the title was actually Corporate Media and the Quashing of Dissent. And I think there's been a growing concern around the country about the mega mergers that keep coming on and on. I mean, that's happening throughout the business world, but in terms of who owns the media. And I would argue, and I think many others have argued, it silences dissent and viewpoints across the spectrum, reduces diversity of what's available, and I think it causes a number of problems. I guess I'd like to do some exploring of that, and welcome your input, because I just the other day somebody here mentioned to me one example where they were finding coverage that was just totally dropping certain major things that the media's priorities may not be reflective of the public interest always. And I'm going to quote from a guy, I don't have a clue who he is, Neil Hickey, is reading a column he had written about what the worst case scenario is. Unfortunately, we're not there, but it gets in all forms of media where it makes a difference. He says, what's the worst case scenario in all this? That some transnational company that knows little and cares less about your community, whose main allegiance is to its stockholders and advertisers, will own your local and daily and weekly newspapers, your television radio stations, the cable system, the internet service provider, several of the national networks that serve you, your local video stores, movie houses, many of the magazines and books you read, and all the sports teams in your area, which is actually true. A lot of these same entities own entertainment, they own sports teams, they own cable stations, they own newspapers across the board. You say that would allow for endless cross promotions of the owner's interests and probably very little hard news about anything having negative impact on advertisers or the company itself. Everything you read, see, every opinion, every image, every jot of information would arrive through one corporate filter. I don't actually think that we're ever at the risk of having one filter. I think it's the problem is we have a very small number of all of them similar filters. From similar perspectives, and unlike in the past where TV stations invested heavily in the news because they thought it was part of their obligation because they owned part of the public airwaves or they had access to part of the public airwaves, that's kind of now, well, if it brings in enough money, we spend money on it. If it doesn't, we cut back on it. And William Safire, the writer for New York Times, I thought he summarized it. He's anti-regulation generally, but here he talks about what the problem is. You won't find television magazine programs fearlessly exposing the broadcast lobby's pressure on Congress and the courts to allow station owners to gobble up more stations and cross-own local newspapers, and thereby to determine what information residents of the local market receive. Stop to examine the highly hyped competition that the consolidating media profess to fear, because every time people say, oh, we're concerned about the consolidation. He says, the leading 20 internet sites and the biggest cable channels are already owned by the expansive likes of GE, NBC, Disney, Fox, Gannett, etc. And every time people talk about where we're headed in terms of media, in terms of consolidation, in terms of democracy of the media where the ordinary citizen has access to it, they always talk about, well, cable's there and anybody can have their own local cable program and anybody can have access to the internet. But Safire is pointing out that the gateways to those sources are all controlled by the same media that the same enterprises that own the broadcast stations as well. Safire continues, back in 1996, two largest radio chains owned 115 stations today, and this was written in 2003, 3 years ago. Those two own more than 1,400, that's more than a 10-fold increase, 115 to 1,400. Media mergers have narrowed the range of information and entertainment available to people of all ideologies. Does that make me, William Safire, gasp, pro-regulation? My conservative economic religion is founded on the rock of competition, which since Teddy Roosevelt's day has protected small business and consumers against predatory pricing leading to market monopolization. He quotes one of the members of the FCC who's concerned about that, quote, we're relying on institutions to cover this debate which have interest in the outcome of the debate. And Sapphire says, that inherent conflict of interest is why I've long been banging my spoon against the high chair, which Sapphire has made this a constant thread of his about how concerned he is about it. Anyway, what are the concerns? What are the problems? And the concerns I'm going to list aren't all related to the consolidation of the media, but I would argue that the problem caused by them is amplified by the small number of owners. The first of which is that there's a filtering of the news, the perspectives, the programming to sort out things that are contrary to the owner's interest. That certainly prevents stories critical of the owner of the station or their advertisers. One of the best examples, and this is one that William Sapphire referred to briefly, the congressional giveaway of federal policy related to broadcasting ownership. And back about 1995, Bob Dole was leading the fight against the giving away of the digital broadcast spectrum. He and several others were pointing out it was about $60 billion of public asset we're just giving to him. Anyway, several people pointed out the fact there was not a single broadcast news story about that controversy. People who saw it on C-SPAN and so on were all, I think Dole's position was very popular, but politicians don't like to say that because you're blasting the people who you're hoping give you media coverage. And here, when you stick your neck out to it, you don't even get a word in edgewise because the media doesn't cover it. A similar type of thing when you're critical of other advertisers. I was doing some work on an environmental issue that 3M, a major Minnesota, one of our largest employers, did not like. It was critical of some of the processes they were doing, dealing with the state agency. Very little coverage of it, and one night when I did see a TV coverage of it, it was followed immediately by a news story. The same station, the next story was a new report came out saying that 3M is the best corporate employer to work for in the country by somebody. My story had been going on for several weeks. The one night they picked it to do it was when they had a follow-up story immediately afterwards. Likewise, I would argue it leads to biased coverage. And in this, the example I'll give is another Minnesota example, because that's where I'm familiar with. I've been leading, I would argue, a fight against public subsidies for sports facilities for the last decade, and we lost this year on two of three they were asking for, and probably may lose the third one next year. In any case, wrote a number of commentaries, and know lots of others who were active in the issue who wrote commentaries for the papers. They didn't get run. Oh yeah, there'd be an occasional letter to the editor run, but a whole lot of issues. I wrote one the last week before the vote, and the paper, I called them to follow up. Well, you know, space is kind of tight, and well, we think we've covered these perspectives before, which they hadn't. But in the front page of the paper, I argue, an editorial, they have a big full-color photo the day before the vote showing some Minnesota Twins fans barbecuing at a tailgate party outside Miller Ballpark in Milwaukee. And it said something like, in just a couple years, Minnesota Twins fans may be able to tailgate outside the new outdoor ballpark. A full-color ad. It looked like a wonderful time. I thought it was a little bit strange, especially since the ballpark's being put surrounded by parking ramps, so you really couldn't do a lot of tailgating there. But the coverage was constant, and it's in editorial. Certainly, it's also in the nature of the news stories. I think that's one example. I think we all have examples where both sides of a lot of issues are going to feel they're being cheated by the news media. So I don't want to make too big of a point about this issue I care about is something. But there are lots of times when you can point to the fact that it's contrary to the owner's interest of perspective. They shut it down and they hype the perspective that's helpful to them. I would argue also that there's a little bit of a problem with filtering out news and perspectives and programming that's contrary to the owner's political interest, perhaps. I know that one radio station in Minnesota, it actually happens to be owned by a broadcasting company that owns the Minnesota Wild hockey team, which had come to the city of St. Paul for funding. They gave, they were paying the mayor of St. Paul, an ally of theirs who had helped get their funding through, they were paying him $500 a week to do a two-hour radio show. political opponent said, hey, wait a minute, it's not fair. He would say, oh, don't worry, I'm not talking about politics. I'm not promoting my candidacy. But most politicians, frankly, would be thrilled to have 2 hours on the air every week on a major station. The fact that they're getting paid to do it as well by somebody who, the owner of a station who was helped by them earlier, it shows the kinds of problems. Equal time provisions are gone, attempts at fairness are gone, and the obligation that stations have to serve the public. I didn't realize this until once a few years ago, that radio stations had an obligation, and I believe they still may, that they have to put on at least a half hour of public affairs broadcasting a week. And that means even if it's a country station, you might have to have some news coverage. Maybe you do it 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there. You know, I got a call from a radio station in northern Minnesota. It was a fairly decent-sized station. I was familiar with it, at least. And the guy wanted to do an interview. I don't remember what the issue was. This is 4 or 5 years ago. And he says, yeah, it's not live. We're taping it for a thing. We did a half-hour interview. I said, well, when do you air it? He says, 5:30 Sunday morning, and it happened to be Easter Sunday that mine was going to be there. I thought, I'm glad I had a private one-on-one conversation with him, because that's probably about, actually, because it was farm country, there may have been a few farmers listening at 5:30 on Easter Sunday, but that was their time slot for their public affairs broadcasting. And I'm glad they put the half-hour thing on. It's probably not worth my time to do it. They're not my constituents, but it is nice that they do some, but it just shows how they try and they've kind of given up on the provisions, and again, equal time and fairness doctrine things have kind of gone out the window. Finally, I would argue that they have an incentive to filter out news, programming, perspectives, and so on that are controversial, or again, that ties into the same thing that may hit their advertising. And again, one example I'll give of this was the and there are plenty of other examples, but one that was a politically related one, the Dixie Chicks group. I don't even know what kind of music they do. I'm kind of out of touch with this, but I remember reading the news stories about their controversy. They had been critical of administration and were attacked by lots of people in the public. There were lots of people who may have liked them for what they said, lots of them who didn't like it for what they said. The broadcasters, basically, they reading an article, they apparently have a new album out that was very popular, but they talked about for a year or two, they were basically banned from the playlist from most of the stations. And I know like Clear Channel, which owns mega number of stations now, one of the largest too, they just put something on, we're gonna play yours, and they tend to favor the artists that they like, they'll put on. But controversy, anything related to that, is gonna hurt their advertising budget because it hurts their listenership, so they drop it. And again, the other side of, instead of just filtering out perspectives they want, they also have the idea of promoting. The fact that I think it's WGN has nationwide cable stations much get it cheap or something, but Chicago Cubs get a lot more coverage because of that. Certainly one of the reasons baseball, football teams and so on are trying to get their own sports networks. Our Minnesota Twins tried that. It failed. Lots of team owners, George Steinbrenner and the Yankees, they have all kinds of packages they put together. And the more media they own, not only can they promote their own things better, but they can do the pricing for advertisers. If you want to have access to the market, well, we got the newspaper, we got the TV, we got the radio stations. You got to come to us if you want to advertise, and we set the rates. Along with this filtering problem is one that this is not caused by the media, but I think it really leads to concern, and that is we've got a less tolerant and less understanding public, which makes some of this more likely to happen. Bill Maher reviewed a survey that was done of high school students a year ago now. It said that a majority of high schoolers think newspapers should not be allowed to publish without government approval. Almost 1 in 5 said Americans should be prohibited from expressing unpopular opinions. This is high school kids. I think we ought to be awfully alarmed at that. His description is what's frightening is we're seeing the beginnings of the first post 9/11 generation, kids who first became aware of the news under the new thing where you challenge something and it's not good, you shouldn't be challenging. I think we got to question whether we're creating the critical thinkers we need in order to have a good, healthy democracy. The next issue I'd like to touch into, which I think is, again, not caused by the media consolidation, it is caused in part by the cost-cutting nature of the new owners, where they try and cut back on the news-gathering operations. But it's also perhaps laziness or just poor journalism. I would argue that the TV stations see that it's a lot cheaper to run Survivor-type reality shows. Apparently, they're very inexpensive to run, and they're very popular, so they run that instead. They cut back news programs, public affairs programs, in exchange for that. But I'm going to read one example from Paul Krugman, who's another New York Times columnist. This was written in July of 2004. He wrote, 3 weeks ago, the New Republic reported the Bush administration was pressuring Pakistan to announce a major terrorist capture during the Democratic Convention. Hours before Mr. Kerry's acceptance speech, Pakistan announced several days after the fact that it had apprehended an important al-Qaeda operative. Now, that's not something that, if you're a TV station, you get the news, a broadcaster, you get the news that a major al-Qaeda operative has been captured, you ought to run the story on it. In politics, there are all kinds of things, dirty tricks to try and undercut your opponent's thing, but when you've got a news magazine reporting a couple weeks earlier that they're pressuring another country to announce this during a key time, and they announce it a few hours before what most presidential candidates consider the prime media spotlight time they have in the campaign, when they get their party's nomination, their acceptance speech, it seems to me important that the broadcasters point out that this was set up in such a way and it was released at that time, which doesn't make it look so good. It's something that the dirty tricks occur if people refuse to do it. And one other example, and I would argue that this is lazy broadcasting, lazy journalism, or it's partly, I'm not sure how much to say attributed to laziness, how much it's to what they think is popular marketing, but I think there's a lot of concern I've heard from Democratic and Republican friends who are concerned that the media picks up, they want to follow the horse race aspect of a political campaign. They want to talk about who's in front, who's raised the most money, what the polls are showing, that sort of thing. And I guess, you know, my feeling is the media ought to report and let people decide, because one of the main ways the public gets access to where candidates stand on the issues, they certainly do have the internet, that's a democratizing impact of new media, but one of the key ways where the public does get it is from the media. Like something like 60% of Minnesotans a few years ago were reporting that the number one news source they relied on for political information was the TV news. And maybe your states are better than ours, but the ones I've seen, a half-hour news is about 6-7 minutes of commercials, 5 minutes of weather, 5 minutes of sports, something about the police, the firefighters getting a cat out of a tree, and some bloody murder, and if they talk about politics, it's two sentences, and it's often during campaign season, who's gaining in the polls, or something like that, far more than any substantive coverage of the issues. And I have two examples of this one I wanted to talk on. This one, the first one was ABC News debate before the New Hampshire primary in 2004. It was December 2003, I guess. It was moderated by Ted Koppel, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who was one of the minor candidates in the race, at least he ended up being one of the minor candidates in the race, he challenged Ted Koppel on, again, this very issue that he was focusing on, the horse race aspect, who got the endorsements, who had the money, who had everything else, and was failing to address the issues. I'm going to just read a little excerpt from this. Koppel, Congressman Kucinich, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what endorsements like this mean or don't mean. And Al Gore had apparently endorsed, I don't know whether it was Edwards or Kerry or Dean or whoever he endorsed, but apparently there had been some discussion in the debate about how people were saying, oh, Gore's endorsement means nothing except, and Koppel legitimately then says, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what endorsements like this mean or don't mean. When you hear some of your colleagues here, you know, I get a little bit of a sense of sour grapes here. If anyone else on the stage had gotten Al Gore's endorsement, he would have been happy to have it. What do you think? Kucinich, well, I can't say I was really counting on it. Laughter. But let me say, Ted, let me say some of the best talent in American politics is up on the stage right now. Applause. With all due respect to you, Ted Koppel, who I've admired over the years greatly, Koppel. There's a zinger coming now, isn't there? Yes. Laughter. To begin this kind of a forum with a question about an endorsement, no matter by who, I think actually trivializes the issues before us. Applause. For example, at this very moment, there are 130,000 troops in Iraq. I mean, I'd like to hear from you asked during this event, what's the plan for getting out? The war is not over. I have a plan which is on my website, which he advertises, to get the U.S. out of Iraq. I want to talk about that tonight. I hope we have a substantive discussion tonight. We're not going to spend the night talking about endorsements. Koppel then cuts Kucinich off, goes to Howard Dean with a question about the same endorsement. Later in the debate, Koppel, this is a question for Ambassador Braun, Reverend Sharpton, Congressman Kucinich. You don't have any money, or at least not much. And those would be the three candidates who probably had the least money. So it's a reasonable direction to ask, but again, it's all focusing on the money. Kucinich, we've raised $4.5 million. I mean, that's not nothing. Laughter. Koppel, you've got about $750,000 in the bank right now, and that's close to nothing when you're coming up against this kind of opposition. But let me finish the question. Question is, will there come a point when polls, money, and ultimately the actual votes that take place here in places like New Hampshire, caucuses in Iowa, will there come a point when we can expect one or more of the three of you to drop out? Or are you in this as sort of a kind of vanity candidacy? Koppel to Kucinich. When will you pull out? Kucinich, after I take the oath of office, when you're there to cover it. After. And I can tell you, Ted, you know, we started at the beginning of this evening talking about endorsement. Well, I want the American people to see where the media takes politics in this country. To start with endorsements. Applause. We start talking about endorsements. Now we're talking about polls. Then we're talking about money. Well, you know, when you do that, you don't have to talk about what's important to the American people. Ted, I'm the only one up here that's actually applauded. And he talks about they actually voted for this and against that and so on. It continues on and on and on, and Koppel drops him and goes on. Anyway, the reason I read you that extensive thing is the next day, ABC News pulls reporter off Kucinich campaign. Right. They had an embedded reporter with each of the campaigns. They dropped him off. You could argue that it was, he was one of the behind candidates. They didn't have the budget. The Kucinich campaign's website said, attributed to their Koppel, being challenging Koppel for avoiding questions. And it said that the reporter had given no warning that such a move was coming and had discussed at length the day before with the Kucinich campaign staff her plans and what her needs were for the coming months. And reporters generally tell the campaign, you know, if we're going to cover you, we need this and this and this. She had discussed that the day before, apparently. No hint that they were going to drop her. The next day they dropped her. And this was, again, before the New Hampshire primary, before the Iowa caucus, before any votes had been taken anywhere. Kucinich campaign was claiming he's a credible candidate. He was among the top three candidates in website traffic, which, again, that's not money. A number of meetup groups, which were those new things that Howard Dean had a lot of. And he was second place finish in the Move On online primary, which I recall was a fairly big thing among Democratic candidates. Is his punishment for challenging the media? I would argue it is. The other candidates, do you think they're going to go and say, listen, to Ted Koppel or anywhere, are you going to challenge them again? They push you off. And again, when there are very few stations, one major station like that has a big impact, and frankly, Kucinich's campaign did dry up. You can argue it's because it's not cause and effect, it's the reverse cause and effect. They dropped him because he wasn't getting anywhere. I'd argue before there's a single primary, before there's any indication where the voters are, that it may have the opposite direction of impact. And then related to the fairness in coverage, the media deference to authority. Media tends to, I like to think of journalism as a muckraking profession. They're supposed to dig up scandals. And there have been plenty of scandals in every one of the last administrations at the federal level. There are plenty of scandals at most state governments. And too often it becomes coverage that they don't dig up what they need. One guy, again, another columnist who I don't know anything about him, Mark Crispin Miller, says the press must help protect us against those who would abuse the powers of government. The oligopoly is far too cozy with the White House and the Pentagon, whose faults and crimes it's unwilling to expose. The media's big bosses want favors from the state, while reporters are afraid to risk annoying their best sources because such politeness and, of course, the current panic in the air. The U.S. coverage of this government is just a bit more edifying than the local broadcasts in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, which we all point out, for obvious reasons, they don't give a lot of, you don't expect media in certain other countries. They're state-run media. And their point here, But Jim Lehrer, I think, is one of the most respected journalists. The deference even comes from people like him. Jonathan Merman, who I don't know, I apologize, I don't know who these columnists or writers are. Jonathan Merman quoted Jim Lehrer from public television, acknowledging that unless an official says something isn't so, it isn't news. Why were journalists not discussing the occupation of Iraq? Because, says Jim Lehrer, the word occupation was never mentioned in the run-up to the war. Washington talked about the war as a war of liberation, not a war of occupation. So as a consequence, those of us in journalism never even looked at the issue of occupation. Merman says, in other words, if the government isn't talking about it, we don't report it. He continues, Lehrer's somewhat jarring declaration, one of many recent admissions by journalists that the reporting failed to prepare the public for the occupation that's followed the liberation of Iraq, reveals just how far the actual practice of American journalism has deviated from the First Amendment idea of a press that is independent of government. And on this same issue, Bill Moyers described Judith Miller of the New York Times as essentially a government stenographer on the claims that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction because she took information from an unnamed source that later proved to be false, and it became kind of a scandal at that time. But Moyer says, instead of acting as filters for readers and viewers sifting the truth from the propaganda, reporters and anchors all tentatively transcribe both sides of the spin, invariably failing to provide context, background, or any sense of which claims hold up and which are misleading. He says, objectivity is not satisfied by two opposing people offering different opinions, leaving the viewer to split the difference. I came to believe objective journalism means describing the object being reported on, including the little fibs and fantasies, as well as the big lie of people in power. Moyer says, conventional rules of beltway journalism allow journalists to pretend they've done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news. He says, in no way does this permit journalists to make accusations, allegations. It means instead making sure your reporting and conclusions can be nailed to the post with confirming evidence. This is always hard to do, but never harder. Without a trace of irony, the powers that be have appropriated newspeak of George Orwell's 1984 program vowing No Child Left Behind while cutting funds for disadvantaged children, etc. The next concern, and I only have about two more, the next concern I would say we get from the media consolidation is, again, the lack of diversity. And this is partly caused by the media's desire to play to desirable, as they call it, demographics. Young, wealthier people are covered much more, or attended to much more, because they're the buyers, the argument goes. I'm not sure if they are, but they do studies. And so older folks, the poor, working people, tend not to get as much coverage as young folks with lots of disposable income. So you tend to gear your programming to get the audiences you want. And that tends to ignore minority perspectives. And I'm not talking just about racial minorities, that's part of it, but also political minorities and religious minorities. The broadcast spectrum in all of our media ought to be meeting, and Sapphire's needs when he talked about how it's limiting the perspectives anybody gets, regardless of where you are politically or philosophically or ideologically. I think the way we could look at this is if you were Jewish or Hindu or Muslim, you probably would expect to see a lot of Christmas programming on television, in the papers, everywhere, because it's predominantly Christian society, overwhelmingly so. So you'd expect to see some of that. But maybe you'd expect there might be a TV station, there might be some coverage somewhere of your religious holidays and so on as well. But again, we limit the focus to, we have the cookie cutter approach. In Minnesota, the college I went to, St. Olaf College, had a public radio station of its own, and Minnesota Public Radio, which is a public broadcasting network, owns 30 or 40 stations. They bought it out, and they've got higher listenership than St. Olaf College did, but they're doing their program, and it's relatively speaking innovative programming. They've got a lot of good programming, but they quashed all of their competitors. When one station tried to put in a new station in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which is a sizable small town in Minnesota, a number of years ago, with a little public funding, which is available to stations that don't have any other public broadcasters within like 40 or 50 miles, Minnesota Public Radio quickly put in a repeating transmitter there. So they couldn't say they had no station routes. They undercut their competitors. And again, one of the things that at least small public radio stations in Minnesota did. There was one for the Hmong community. There are all kinds of unique programming that you get if you have small stations. And that lack of diversity of perspective multiplies the impact of poor journalism when you get to controversial subjects like in politics. You get the lemming type of approach to journalism, which I often see at our state capitol headquarters. One reporter writes something, all seem to write the same thing. That's oversimplification of it, but the fewer network outlets you have, the fewer ownerships you have, the more you're going to tend to have cookie-cutter reporting, cookie-cutter journalism, cookie-cutter programming aimed at getting the biggest audience. And I'm not saying everybody doesn't want the biggest audience, but maybe instead of 10 stations playing top 40 music, maybe you want one that has country western. Well, that's probably equally popular. You want one that has classical, one that has country western. One might have this sort of thing, and one might have that sort of thing, all of which have their own niche instead of going for the same niche of most popular thing and competing with the others. It's not the way to do it. And then final concern I wanted to mention, and this is one that is not necessarily, again, caused, it's more related to the poor reporting than the consolidation, but again, it makes the problem of consolidation worse. And this is, again, it was a column I started quoting from earlier from Paul Krugman. Under the headline of it, this is from July of 2004, the middle of the last presidential campaign. Under the headline, "Voters Want Specifics from Kerry," the Washington Post recently quoted a voter demanding that John Kerry and John Edwards talk about, quote, what they plan on doing about health care for middle-income or lower-income people. "I have to face the fact I will never be able to address health insurance the way things are now. And these millionaires don't seem to address that." And Krugman points out that Kerry had proposed a $650 billion health insurance plan for low and middle income families to cover uninsured folks. $650 billion, which is a lot of money. He was going to pay for it with a rollback of tax cuts. And Krugman is saying whether you approve of that plan or not, you can't say he hasn't addressed the issue. Why hasn't this voter heard about it? So Krugman went through 2 months of transcripts from, he described, I think he said, the five major news networks. And he went through 2 months of their transcripts for the entire thing. He said not only couldn't he find the details of Kerry's plan, he couldn't even find a clear statement that Kerry had planned to roll back tax cuts and use the money for health care. Couldn't find a single statement in 2 months. The voter says, and the article was critical about how voters are waiting for specifics for him. I know that is a problem I have when I, in my small races, when I try and get message out. Well, how do you do it? You can't get any coverage of any substance on it. I, as an incumbent, have an advantage that a challenger doesn't have because all during the other years I can write about things I'm working on. But a challenger can come in there and have no access. The media doesn't cover anything about their campaign. It's grossly unfair. Krugman continued on. He said, while voters have no way of knowing about Kerry's health care plan, he said, everyone knew that Theresa Heinz Kerry told someone to shove it. Though even there, the context was missing. I remember this incident. When I was reading this, it brought it back. He said, except for a brief reference on MSNBC, none of the transcripts I've read mention the target of her ire was an employee of Richard Mellon Scaife, a billionaire who financed smear campaigns against the Clintons, including accusations of murder. CNN did mention Mr. Scaife on its website, but described him only as a donor to conservative causes and nothing about Mr. Scaife's long vendetta against Ms. Heinz Kerry herself. He says these two issues in his mind are related to trivialization and bias. He says somewhere along the line, TV news stopped reporting on candidates' policies, turned instead to trivia that supposedly reveal their personalities. We hear about Mr. Kerry's haircuts, not his health care proposals. We hear about George Bush's brush cutting, not his environmental policies. And then he says, well, you know, this celebrity style reporting leads to biased reporting. And his example, he says, note this voter's reference to these millionaires. And the quote he had from the Washington Post was, I have to face these facts. I'll never have health insurance the way things are. These millionaires don't seem to address that. He says, note the voter's reference to these millionaires. He said, a Columbia Journalism Review website says its analysis reveals the press prone to needlessly introduce Kerry and Edwards and Kerry's wife as millionaires or billionaires without similar labels for Bush or Cheney. As the Columbia Journalism site points out, Bush campaign has been, quote, hammering away with talking points, casting carriers out of the mainstream because of his wealth, hoping to influence press coverage. And Krugman says, the campaign isn't claiming that Mr. Kerry's policies favor the rich. They manifestly don't, while Mr. Bush's manifestly do. Instead, we're supposed to dislike Mr. Kerry simply because he's wealthy and not notice his opponent is too. Again, Mr. Krugman is a Democratic-leaning columnist, which you can tell from, he says, Mr. Kerry's policies manifestly don't favor the rich and Bush's do. But the point is, Columbia Journalism Review site is pointing out that that's one of the talking points. Keep referring to them as millionaires, billionaires, and they're wealthy people, as all four of the major candidates, president and vice presidential candidates, were. Well, where do we go from this? What direction is there? At the beginning, I talked a little bit about the promise of new democratic access to the media, where you could have your own cable program. And in Minnesota, all the cable stations, when they got access to a city, when a city gave cable access to a certain company, they virtually assured their viewers that there'd be some public access stations. Every few communities in Minnesota has a public access station where you can go to for a cable company and you can do your own filming. They've got the not their best cameras or anything, but they got cameras there that you can use. They have volunteers who work there. They even have a staff person or two. That's all negotiated in their cable contracts. And we get out of that in Minnesota, at least, we have pretty decent local programming available to school districts, to the city. They actually have all the city councils in my district, the 7 or 8 I have. I think every one of their council chambers is wired for cable television, and they broadcast their meetings. It may seem kind of dull to some of us, but it's the one way people have who are of getting access to their city officials, the same way they have our hearings are broadcast, and C-SPAN does it in Washington. So there is a lot of promise with that. But again, with that or internet, anybody can put up, I got a couple of internet sites. Anybody can put up an internet website, get their information out. But the reason it hasn't worked out to its promise is, again, the gateway to the internet, the gateway to cable is the cable companies who sell their packages of stuff. It's the Googles and the Yahoos and everybody else. It's a handful of people, and they're now being bought up by the broadcasting companies, the same conglomerates that own broadcasting, now trying to get more into newspapers and into the internet. It doesn't do me a lot of good to have a website up that gets my message out to people if nobody knows it's there. And there is no easy way to get access to those things. And so the person who does their own cable show with some perspective, I mean, there are some over years build up listenership in some ethnic community or so on, but at least in Minnesota, very few gain wide popularity, wide knowledge, because nobody knows they're there. And if you are saying, oh, I'm going to put up my own website and I'm going to do this and nobody knows it's there, you might as well talk to a brick wall. You're not getting the audience. So I think while there's a lot of promise for more democracy in the media, we're not nearly there. So in the 20-some minutes we have left, I hope that the discussion can not only talk about, if you have examples of things that have irritated you about this, but also if people have comments on, do you see this going any other way than the way it's going? I think the mergers, the new head of the FCC is a little bit changed from the previous one. The courts struck down and members of both parties in Congress fought against the merger thing where they were taking off the caps and how many stations you could own, how much of the market you could dominate. But there's a lot of bipartisan support in Congress to fight that. So who knows what that'll happen there. But the trend is very clear. It's going that way. And again, we do have these democratic alternatives where you can have your own little thing. But again, they're not widely heard. Does anybody have comments on that as well? But I'm opening up for whatever direction you want to take it. Yes?
I have two comments to make, John. One, I share, I think, an opinion that you expressed about journalists being lazy. And I can't come up quite with the specifics, but I know in the last couple of months it was clear that the journalists did not take the time to search out the details that were important to the story. Secondly, is the language that journalists often choose to characterize something on which they were reporting. And I looked at two instances. One, when my wife was on a negotiation team with a local school board, the local newspaper consistently would talk about the teachers angrily presenting a proposal. And it was nothing of the sort. She finally went down to the newspaper and very nicely suggested, you know, that isn't what was going on.
You weren't angry, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it isn't appropriate. More recently, I had a conversation up here with a public official whose name shall go unmentioned, who has yet to be quoted in a rather large regional newspaper correctly, always with a rather negative, pejorative sort of term, reporting on, and he's in education. I mean, it's a relatively straightforward sort of story, but always tilted it a bit with some negative language. And I think that the choice of words often by journalists can sway so quickly the tone of a newspaper.
Yeah, I was going to say that journalists would be, I mean, Moyer's comment that they feel they're doing being objective, they report the spin on both sides. I had some hearings which I was so convinced the other side was, the witnesses for a state agency were lying, that I put the guy under oath. And we got a different answer from him after that. The reporters on the thing, it's a he said, she said. And the voters, the public, the citizens who are trying to get informed, well, who's telling the truth? I don't know, maybe neither of them is.
That's lazy journalism.
That's lazy,
just
right.
Report the spin and not get
that's right. And why they have to do it, somebody's ultra-conservative, ultra-liberal, why somebody is angrily this, why can't they report it? I know I've often done a 40-minute interview, and they'll use three sentences, and you know that, but you'll be saying this and this and this. You know, I do recognize that this is the case, but, and then the one line they do is, I recognize this is the case. And so I'll always pick, instead of a longer story where they're going to use 3 minutes of interview stuff, but they select it, I'd much rather have a one-minute live interview, because then you get to say what you want to say in context.
Pick the soundbite.
Yeah, but again, that's the bias, which is, I think, sometimes lazy. I don't know that it's always intentional. We're trying to attack somebody, but again, campaigns are very good at putting spin on, and the example they gave there of the millionaires. I mean, Bush campaign's trying to do that, Kerry campaign's trying to do other things, and when they pick up the spin that somebody puts out, they use somebody else's descriptor. That's laziness. Yes?
I live in a small town in Washington, and I was a teacher.
Sorry, also. We can't hear you.
I live in a small town in Washington, and I was a teacher, and I went to a meeting about a school bond issue. And there was one person who spoke against the school bond issue, and everyone else in this meeting, everyone, spoke very positively about it. The whole article in the newspaper was about that one person who spoke negatively. And I called them up, and I said, I was there at that meeting. And I said, exactly what happened. He said, oh, well, this is more newsworthy. And I mean, I was at another thing, and actually there's someone from the Edward R. Murrow School of Communication, which is at WSU, and there was someone up there. And he was on the stage in a panel discussion, and people were talking about these kinds of issues. And he said, well, if you're counting on the newspapers to give and the news media to give a biased report, you're making a big mistake. I mean, unbiased report, a balanced, unbiased report, you're making a big mistake.
See, I feel we'd be much better off if we had what we once had, much more blatantly partisan, not necessarily political party, but blatantly philosophical, this is our perspective. When they're twisting the news that kind of way anyway, it would help if at least people say, well, this is the paper that's that way, this is the one this way. But they all have their own mix, it's frustrating to people.
You know, I've been at several events where when I saw the event reported on the news, I thought, wait, that can't be the same event. But I think that's more than lazy journalism. I think it's unethical. And I think it's more than just, you know, furthering a spin from one side or the other. It seems like there are no standards for if you're there and the candle is white, that if you report on the candle that you say it's white instead of saying it was lit by a lesbian, you know, or something. That there should be some continuity or some basic professional standards. And I don't know much about professional journalism. I don't know if there are. In every other field there are. So I wonder about that.
On that point, I know in crime reporting in Minnesota, they make a big point whenever they disclose a criminal or a suspect's race or something like that. They try and say, here's what, if it's not relevant to the story and they're not trying to track down a person, they won't, they say we shouldn't report their religion, their race, certain other things. So they seem to talk about that a lot related to crime, but I never hear it about any other thing about, you know, why they put a slam in. And I'm sensitive about myself, I'm sure my colleagues, all my colleagues the same way, when they put a tag word on you that relates nothing to the story. Oh, this is the guy who's such and such, when they're talking about somebody's views on something else.
So John, what is your tag? Well, what's your tag?
What's my tag on how to do it?
No, what's your tag? How did the press try to tag you?
Thank you.
Anti-sports.
Anti-sports is what I'm, yeah.
So we need to get a picture out of the home field throwing a football.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I actually made sure I have a little stuffed Vikings football that plays music. I don't know where I got it. I put that on my thing, and when a reporter was saying, oh, you like football? I threw it to him, and it starts playing when you throw it.
Maybe you need a bobblehead, John.
Yeah, I need the bobblehead. But I was actually, this year, was hoping to be able to vote for the Gopher, Minnesota University of Minnesota Gopher Stadium, because it wasn't a private business subsidy, but it was going to cost $1.7 million for every home game for the next 25 years to build it, which I thought was high. So then that leads to the, you're anti-sports. And the Vikings lobby is very routinely just, he said in a couple here, oh, Marty just hates sports, which isn't true, but I mean, how do you get past it? Yes.
Let me offer a little different perspective. I've spent more than 30 years in journalism. And I agree with much of what you say. I've spent most of my career in newspapers. I actually started out in television news. Lasted less than a year because it became quite evident to me that the sizzle was more important than television than the steak. And considering what happened in Caroline, it was a wise career move. But let me make one point, and that's that all of the sources you've cited that are critical of the press are the press. I mean, you're quoting Paul Krugman, you're quoting Bill Moyers. I've spent my career in this business, and I don't know of another profession that is more self-critical and more self-analytical. We're always figuring out what we can do better. There's an awful lot of bad journalism out there. A lot of it's laziness. A lot of it has to do with the corporate structure and just how much time and how many resources the news organizations have. And I wanted to make one other point on top of what you said, not so much about consolidation, but what's going on in newspapers now is really scary. Many of the largest newspapers in this city, in this country, are owned by publicly traded corporations that trade on Wall Street, just like General Motors or Ford or something more profitable. And Wall Street doesn't look at. I mean, the press is the only industry in this country that's mentioned in the Constitution. Automobiles aren't mentioned in the Constitution. Semiconductors aren't mentioned in the Constitution, but the press is. But Wall Street, doesn't matter to Wall Street. Right. All Wall Street sees is, what were the earnings last quarter? And there have been a number of newspaper chains that have cut back, and ultimately Knight Ridder, one of the largest ones, just had to put itself up for sale and basically get carved into pieces because it couldn't satisfy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And that, in my view, and we depend on newspapers for so much else. What television news reports, for the most part, other than the latest traffic accident or fire or murder, they all get from the newspapers. All the blogs, the Daily Kos, all the others, most of what they get is commenting on newspapers. And what happens to newspapers is vital to the future of this country, to my future.
It was interesting when you told me the other night that you were working on this. You were reviewing, actually, on this topic. I was going to, if I had seen you here, I would have read this from the William Sapphire column. He says, you won't find many newspaper chains assigning reporters to reveal the effect of media gigantism on local coverage or cover the way publishers induce coverage-hungry politicians to loosen antitrust restraints. I was going to read that if I saw you here because I thought you said you're actually working on something related to that. And I think it is a good point that the people, the Sapphires, the Krugmans, the Moyers that I'm quoting, are journalists. And they're very critical of their own. Actually, they're somewhat critical. Moyers was very critical of his colleagues. Some of the rest of them, well, I guess they all were critical of their colleagues, but they were also critical, as was Sapphire, of the structure that's causing a lot of this to happen. That's a good point, but I was going to use that line if I saw you here, because I thought, since you were actually doing the one thing Sapphire didn't think, but again, that's the exception. Nobody else does that, and they understandably.
Another market dynamic that unless we think this is all about the conservative press, in my town of about 150,000, we have a New York Times-owned paper. And the way it works, and you...
Santa Rosa?
Yeah. Very good. And the way it works is that, you know, if a reporter comes to work for the New York Times company and they get assigned to Santa Rosa, right, they're from a career standpoint, what that reporter wants to do is move up the ladder as quickly as possible. Now, I don't know what's between Santa Rosa and New York City, but there's probably a couple...
There are probably some
steps in between. But to get there, how does that reporter get there? The way that reporter gets there is by being controversial. And the way that report, by basically finding stories, or I would contend, shaping stories to have conflict. And it's sort of an extension of the notion you were referring to. If it bleeds, it leads. You want to talk about what the professional standards are in journalism? That's the number one thing. You want to have your story be above the fold on the front page. And the way you get above the fold on the front page is you make it controversial. That doesn't mean it's necessarily about what actually happened. It's about promoting the one guy who stood up and said, this bond measure is lousy. Because that's the story that's going to get that reporter noticed and put to the next paper, and then the next paper, and then eventually maybe they get to go to New York City. So it's more than just that's an extension of the Wall Street mentality, which is, you know, the papers get sold to the extent that they have that kind of titillation. But it's more insidious, I think, than...
I had not thought of your perspective there, but I'll agree with that. I will say that a lot of the if it bleeds, it leads is not so much the journalists themselves deciding as the editors, and especially TV journalism, the editors deciding it's the first story because it's the attention-getting one.
But the reporters pick up that, yeah. You know, and integrate that into how they write their story.
I know what sells.
And a backup BBC, one of our public broadcasting stations in Minnesota, backup coverage at 10 o'clock at night has BBC World News. And it really is interesting. You can learn a lot about what's going on in the world by listening to it. Because it's news. It's not. I mean, whether it's an earthquake or tsunami or something, that does get a lot of attention. Right. But murders, plane crashes get brief one sentence, and they talk much more about the politics of things. And in a democracy, you kind of need that. But I would say also, though, that I think it's not always reporters. Sometimes they try and make it juicier, more controversial than it is. What I'd say is also a part, I mean, in the political world, I know I can do a major thing that has to do with major environmental issue or major tax policy thing, and it'll get zero coverage. And I can do something related to a stadium, and boy, that's front page news. Front page news, except when it became really hot and they were kind of really seriously trying to get it passed. Then they just kind of dropped it all. Anyway, other directors?
I think we've heard a lot of stories about frustrations that people have had about stories not being accurate, or maybe technically accurate, but the impression that they give is incorrect. And it's true that the media are owned by corporations. However, they also operate under FCC license.
Only television and radio, not newspapers.
But to the extent that those violate someone's standards, I think it's extremely important to write that station and name the reporter and what your problem is with it. Find out when that station comes up for license renewal and show up again. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that changes the world, but I do think that it's something that frustrated people can do other than just complain.
Who do you think sits on the FCC?
Pardon?
Who do you think sits on the FCC?
I know who sits on the FCC.
But it is worth complaining. It may not change everything, but you have no choice but to complain if so. And I feel as part of my obligation to correct a reporter when they're wrong, complain when news coverage is poor. I had a columnist who wrote simply fabricated a quote, something I had, and I had the tape of the hearing to show I didn't say it. I actually ended up meeting with the editor of the paper about it, and he said, well, I can't make the guy apologize, but I'll make sure he calls you. He never called me, but...
but in terms of that person's career...
No rejection.
I think it's important in terms of that news reporter's career.
I think it is important.
That someone calls them on it.
And I'm telling you, worst case here, I have another case where a reporter, this is 15 years ago, reporter's now retired, but I said something, you know, he was asking me about a real controversial issue, and I had a position, I said, wait. He said, well, are your constituents agreeing on that? Because he thought that was unlikely. I said, well, actually, I've only had about a dozen calls or letters, and about six of one side and six of the other side. He wrote the thing, Marty said that he's only had about a dozen calls, and they were strongly opposed to what he was doing, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I called him on it. He said, well, I'm sure I got that right. Oh, sure I didn't. He just argued with me, came back the next day, said, I'm so embarrassed. I checked my notes. You were right. You said 601. And I got the apology. I didn't get anything in writing. But I took it that, you know, the reporters can be a little more careful next time. And there's some merit in doing that. But does anybody have any suggestions? I mean, other than, and I do think it's important to contact the journalist and the publisher. I don't have as much optimism as you about contacting the FCC, but I think it's probably worth doing. But other suggestions, other directions.
I'm just curious about the fact that so few people, probably under 40, are even reading papers. I'd like some conversation.
Is it making any difference?
Well, no, that the information people are increasingly getting are not from newspapers, but from TV, from blogs. They're, they're getting their information from biases that they want to hear it from. Yeah. And that's if they're reading at all. Or getting it from TV, which, as we've all observed, has no real news of political or other.
Yeah, how do you run a democracy?
How scary is that?
If people don't read, and your second point, that if you're only listening to people you agree with, because I was talking to somebody earlier today about the polarization in our debate. You can't go, not just in politics, but elsewhere. You used to be able to disagree, and I don't want to over-glorify the past, but be able to disagree, and, well, we're still neighbors, we're still friends. We just disagree. It seems to be much more, you only listen to people on your side of the fence, which is scary. Any comments on that?
Yeah.
You agree?
Well, in Europe, they have papers that have a particular perspective. They don't pretend to be objective. Right. And I think there is a way in which we have this notion, I mean, I think the myth of objectivity of our press is so pervasive and so damaging that I'm just wondering if we need to go to that model. Now, to get that model, we'd have to have a government that was willing to pass laws that made it such that you couldn't have the kind of monopoly journalism you have here. I don't know that we'll ever get there.
It's not likely in the near future.
Right, but I guess it seems to, I've sort of given up on the press being objective. I got called a whore this year in the press, so
it doesn't help you feel positive.
But I wonder if there's a way of getting to that more European model.
And is it desirable?
Yes.
I mean, I
at least you know what question the bias
too. I think it was interesting. The Baylor student newspaper in Baylor, in Texas, wrote an article on an editorial on gay marriage, and they wrote by a 5-3 vote, their editorial board believes this. New Yorker magazine wrote a wonderful thing saying, "Wouldn't it be nice if New York Times and everybody else told us the votes in their editorial boards on things?" But it'd be truth in advertising, at least. But I don't know. Anyway, did you have a comment?
Just that it seems that we've become, I'm not sure if the word is galvanized or polarized on ends of the extremes, and people seem less inclined to, at least on an intellectual level, listen to those who disagree with them, which actually, you know, ironically has a tendency to fortify your particular perspective, because then you have a greater intellectual foundation to your perspective. Yet what you're describing, you're absolutely right, has a tendency to polarize. And I've never really, I mean, I've sort of observed this phenomenon. I had not attributed it to the press, and I think you're absolutely right. I was talking to some of my friends earlier today. You know, I can't watch Fox. I also can't watch MSNBC. Wolf Blitzer's getting me kind of tensed up. I mean, you know, the point is, there's really nobody you can watch who is going to give you an objective kind of.
Turn them all off and read a newspaper.
I mean, that's an interesting thing. A comedy show gets people.
Yeah, actually, public television seems the closest, but I'm frankly.
I was going to say we need to import BBC here to do our coverage.
Right.
For broadcast, I mean, I feel bad for one television news reporter who's been doing it for 25 years. I keep thinking every year his news stories, he does political news, they used to have a good story, might be 3 minutes long. Now he gets 30 seconds and very little of substance. I keep thinking if I was in journalism, I wouldn't want to be in broadcast journalism other than maybe public radio because there they give him time to do lengthier stories. But we need a change.